This episode of Guitar Radio Show is brought to you by Nico's USA Pickups. The quintessential pickup is finally here to capture the essence of the best vintage and modern tones on the planet. We all know there are certain periods that have captivated guitar players because of their cherished tones. Nico's USA pickups are handmade and designed to deliver just what you're looking for. Made in America, incorporating period-specific materials for the most discerning guitarist, the tone will easily captivate your ears with an amazing balance of highs, mids, and bass response, yielding unprecedented sound and feel. Authentic tones from authentic materials, handcrafted in the USA, Nico's USA Pickups. Go to nicosusapickups.com for more information. With a unique design and construction, DNA Guitars is a clear choice when looking for the all-around guitar. DNA Guitars' recipe for creating perfect instruments is steeped in tradition while looking toward the future. DNA's recessed bridge construction is a five-point contact bridge, a solid brass bridge that is inset into the body, maximizing strength, contact, and string vibration. An incredibly comfortable guitar to play, DNA Guitars molds to your body, and the neck profiles are wonderful to play across. DNA uses an exclusive 100% solderless wiring harness that is designed for guitars with single coil or humbucker setup. Looking for versatility? Look no more. Check out DNA Guitars. Go to dnaguitarcompany.com. Custom guitars handcrafted in the USA. DNA Guitars. Innovation to fuel your inspiration. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 101 of Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to all things guitar, dedicated to the guitar player, guitar builder, gear maker, and purveyors of those items that you may not know about, but you should. And today, I think most everybody's going to know about our guest, who's going to be the subject of a two-part episode today. And then next Wednesday, we've got the incomparable Mr. Frank Marino. This was the most in-depth, definitive interview I've ever done, and one of the most enjoyable I think I've ever done. And I've never had anybody that I've spoken with make me feel more at ease than Frank did. Excuse me. I've always wanted this show to be conversational, and it is. And this was incredibly conversational. Frank made me feel like I knew him forever, and I feel like I have a friend in Frank. It was fantastic. It was great, and I think you're really, really going to enjoy this. This man is brutally honest, and in the sweetest way. It was an honor for me, and disarming and wonderful. And I think you're going to really dig it. Folks, go to guitarradioshow.com. Check out all the show notes there. And tomorrow, Thursday, we have a new blog from Adam P. Hunt. 500 words with Adam P. Hunt, to be exact. And it'll be on the great Steve Marriott. Fantastic. Another hero. So I think you'll dig that a whole bunch. I'm going to get with it. We are over the hump of 100 episodes. Folks, thank you so much for listening to episode 100. You blew me away with the amount of downloads. Just blew me away. I cannot believe what's going on. It's more than I ever expected, but everything I've ever dreamed of. So let's get to it. Here is part one of our episode with Mr. Frank Marino. Guitar Radio Show, guitarradioshow.com. All right, folks. Well, you know, what do Zach Wild, Joe Bonamassa, Eric Gales, Paul Gilbert, and George Lynch have in common? They all cite our next guest as one of their hugest influences. And Guitar Player Magazine has called him a full-spectrum guitar god. Mr. Frank Marino, welcome to Guitar Radio Show. How are you?
How you doing? I'm okay.
How's that for an opening, just waking up in the morning?
Yeah, I really don't know how to deal with that one. That's pretty big.
Well, it's all true. You know, I got to tell you, this is a thrill for me because in 1978, my dad popped me down in front of a TV, a big old TV, one of those console TVs.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, check this out. And it was on ABC, and on came this show, and I'd never seen anything quite like it before, and it was called California Jam 2.
Oh, yeah.
And okay. On comes this guy with long hair almost down to his butt, and he's just playing faster than I'd ever seen anybody play ever, and just tearing it up. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, who is this? And then they flash your name at the bottom of the screen, and it was Frank Marino and Mahogany Rush. And I got to tell you, man, it was one of those life-changing moments when you go, oh, I want to do that. So
a lot of people talk about that Cal Jam thing. I guess it got a lot of television or something like that, you
it
know?
Really did, yeah.
It wasn't one of my favorite shows to do, you know, like a lot of people thought it was, but it really wasn't, you know, just from a personal standpoint, because of the way I feel about the music industry and stuff, I found it very, you know, not the actual show itself, but the politics of playing shows like that, mm-hmm. you know, at the time really sort of went against the grain for me. You had to be backstage to know what I'm talking about. It was right. Very business, sort of business-like corporate corporate thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm more of like a Woodstock guy, you know. So, mm-hmm. so, but you know, it certainly got a lot of television, and you know, it was. I think for me, the nicest thing about doing it at the time was, you know, getting to see Santana.
Well, you know, that was the period where the Suits had figured out a way to use this other medium to start to further monetize music.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, I've often said in the past, coming from, you know, my own roots, that when we went to see, you know, somebody play when we were young, you know, start before we were professional, no one ever called it a show. Mm-hmm. Everyone called it a concert. Mm-hmm. It was just the normal, you know, it was the Woodstock pop concert, you know, like right. People called them concerts, and later on people called them shows. And I think that the simple difference in the word demonstrates the difference in the approach of the promoters and the attitude of how things were being, you know, basically sold later as a show. Mm-hmm. Things got so out of hand in terms of, you know, what bands were doing, were, you know, it had nothing to do with music anymore, right? I mean, okay, we had liquid light shows in the 60s and a couple of light bulbs, but it got so crazy, you know, the shows got so big and it got mm-hmm. so much about the visuals. And today, I think it's even more so. I think today, you know, you've got somebody singing on stage, basically, that's like the biggest stars in the world are, you know, female singers today. And you've got somebody singing, but meantime, what's really going on is, you know, screens and mm-hmm. sparkles and all kinds of, you know, things. It has really not a lot to do with the music as much anymore.
Yeah.
And that was a gradual thing. It didn't happen suddenly. It was just gradual. slowly getting more and more like that, which is what I meant when I said I had some issues with the way shows were done back then, you know, the large shows like Cal Jam.
Well, you know, and also, I find it interesting that after a while, I mean, you know, when an audience is, when there's 350,000 people in the audience, and that's what they say the estimated number was at Cal Jam, and something similar to that at Day on the Green and stuff like that.
I did both of those, and just to tell you, just to cut in for a second, I did both of those, and Day on the Green wasn't 350 like Cal Jam. It was smaller. But even Cal Jam, we got the number that day, which was 330.
Right.
So I'm just letting you know that it was 330,000. That's what they told me that very day.
Right.
And I know that when Bill Graham did Day on the Green, I don't think he got that kind of number. But go on.
But when it gets that big, I mean, at some point, I mean, after the first 50 rows, doesn't it just become like just this sea of humanity?
Well, the interesting thing about what you're saying is that because it's so big, it's not even the first 50 rows. The first row is really far away from the stage.
Right.
There's nobody up against the stage in a show like that.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, you have a very large stage because generally they have all the other acts setting up their gear behind you on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they have like a train rail that they could bring these pallets in like a circle, you know, like changing the bands like that.
Right.
And then, so there's a really large stage, and then there's a drop down, and there's a really large stage again where the camera guys are. And then there's a drop down to the ground, and there's a really large pit for security. So by the time when I'm looking out on stage, from the stage at something like Cal Jam, maybe a little closer on Day in the Green, but Cal Jam, I the first row was like, gosh, like really far away. I can't estimate the actual distance, but, you know, you couldn't read something on someone's T-shirt very well.
Wow. So was there a disconnect?
It was pretty far away.
So was there a disconnect for you as far as that is concerned, or
totally.
How?
Yeah, totally. That's the problem. You know, that's what I'm saying. It's like listening to the music and interacting with the band started to take a real back seat to the event, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was always an event. I mean, even when Bill Graham did shows, you know, in the 60s, he always made it an event.
Mm-hmm.
But the event was the music, you know? The event was actually what the bands were playing,
right,
and the music,
right,
and the variation in it. But as shows became bigger in the 70s, and they really learned how to sell that, you know, properly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, look, just the idea that something like that would be on television.
Yeah.
You know, look, you know, like, that's equivalent to, like, saying, wow, you know, we all love the Beatles, but we never thought we'd hear their music in an elevator.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way. You're right.
And that's what ended up happening, because for music, which was basically the background noise of the anti-establishment movement of the hippie days, that's when it all became big.
Yeah.
To suddenly become the establishment, to the point where they'll say, you know, Cal Jam brought to you by Ford Motor Company, or something like that.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, you know, we have really sort of, you know, stepped out of Kansas.
Yeah.
It's
kind of interesting how the chickens have come home to roost, though, for those corporations, as far as, you know, the record companies. As I was just talking to someone earlier today about the monolith has kind of collapsed in that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, now.
Thank God for a bunch of 14-year-olds with computers, you know.
Yeah.
Who really figured out how to take down the music industry.
Yeah.
I mean, they did, you know, just like, hey, man, let's download this. And bang, that was the end of that.
And created a whole new DIY society.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And look, I'm one of these people that's actually happy that happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not, I'm not bemoaning that at all, really, you know, because the corporateness of our music industry, listen, the ones that are still there, they're still pretty corporate, you know, but I'm a pretty anti-corporate guy, but that's not because it's trendy for me to be that way. It's because I was that way when I was, you know, 10 years old.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So,
I just still like the playing, you know, so that's really what it's really about, the playing.
Well, that's what grabbed me when I saw you. I mean, you know, the first time I saw you, I was like, wow. And, you know, here's the crazy thing. I hadn't been exposed to Hendrix because I didn't have any older siblings. I was an only child, so I didn't know Hendrix. And later on, when I heard Hendrix, and people were saying, "Oh, wow, he's like very Hendrixy," and I'm like, "No, he's not."
Right. Exactly.
No, he's not at all. He doesn't. I says he's his own thing. He's got his own thing, and that's one of the things that I noticed. I always noticed about you is you didn't sound like anybody else.
Well, they certainly used the Hendrix word a lot. And look, I can't blame them. I covered a couple of his tunes, and I only did that because I happened to really like the guy.
Right.
It wasn't like, you know, but I mean, you have no idea how much that albatross hung around my neck for forever. I mean, even till today.
Yeah.
It still happens, you know? It still happens, but the problem is the comparison, you know, that they were making. And then I'm talking about there was two versions of the comparison. There was the comparison that was being made by some listeners, which is basically like, you know, yeah, he does some Hendrix tunes and he does them justice.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the comparison that was made by the media, which was basically, oh, he's just a clone, you know, and it was this whole Hendrix thing.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, many of the musicians of the day took up the media chant. So I spent a hell of a lot of days in a hell of a lot of gigs not being spoken to by a hell of a lot of musicians who really had it in for me because of the quote-unquote Hendrix thing.
Yes, yes.
But I think, I think after so much time had passed, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, and these people began to see, hey, listen, like, this guy never changed. You know, the way he's doing things today, 45 years later, is exactly like he did him in the beginning.
Right.
He never changed. I guess he's pretty serious about it. You know, I guess it's not some kind of a fad or some kind of thing that he's trying to do to sell records.
Yeah.
He's certainly not selling any records. And he's not getting great press for it either.
You know,
then it became acceptable, you know, became acceptable. But then more and more people began to play that style of guitar.
Right.
You know, after, you know, once guys like Stevie Ray Vaughan came along and, you know, the Texas blues thing with the Strat and the Marshall, once that became commonplace, and then the newer, younger players took that to the next level. And now today, I don't know, today that type of approach to guitar is pretty much a type of barometer by how a lot of people judge guitar players.
Yeah.
It's no longer the big bad thing it is, or it used to be, except when I do it.
And then you're getting crucified. Well, you know, it's
funny. I like to say, quite honestly, and I'm not afraid to say it, I say it, that the only reason that happened, the crucifixion of that happened, is because I was first, and because I was young.
Yeah.
I was a 16-year-old kid coming out of Canada who dared to say that this is a way to play guitar, that Hendrix had started basically a paradigm. Much the same way the Beatles started, you know, that type of long-haired rock music.
Yeah.
And, you know, how dare he do that, right?
Yeah. Well, I think there was also...
By the way, he should use a Strat and a Marshall instead of an SG and an acoustic 270 transistor amp.
I think there was also another thing there, too. You know, at that particular point in time, it was all about the British guys. And, you know, everybody was looking that way because they were bringing, and I think you might have been just on the wrong continent at the wrong time.
possible. It's also possible I was at the wrong time.
That too.
In general, because because look, I started playing guitar in 1968. At the end of 68 and 69, basically. Hendrix died in September of 70. So the influence that Hendrix had on me through the little trip that I had, and, you know, as a the acid trip I had in the hospital, the influence was like the influence he'd had on anybody at the time. It wasn't like this any greater influence. It was just Jimi Hendrix was one of the guitar players. And we weren't even thinking of music like guitar players. Today we think of that. You and me, we're guitarists. You know, people today, they think, oh, the guitar player, this guitar player. But in those days, I can tell you, and anybody listening will know that this is true, nobody listening to music in those days says, wow, I'm into that guitar player or I'm into that drummer. What they were following was songs and music of a certain genre, a certain type.
Mm-hmm.
So Hendrix was an influence in a way, the same way that the Doors were, or the Beatles were, or any of the people that brought a very unique sound.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about the sound.
Yeah.
So Hendrix was an influence to me like that, like anybody. But so was Quicksilver, and so was the Doors, and so was the Beatles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you covered their songs.
That in my music, you know.
Yeah, and you covered them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, look, when we say I covered Hendrix, what? I only ever recorded one Hendrix tune.
Right.
It was Purple Haze, and it was live. It was from a live show.
Right.
You know, I never did one on record. And when I did Tales of the Unexpected, me doing All Along the Watchtower was just my way of trying to prove that the critics didn't know what they were talking about, because, you know, I purposely chose a tune they criticized me for Hendrix, and I knew it was Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like,
yeah. Yeah.
And the funny thing was, some of them actually didn't. You know, I said it almost as a joke, like, could you imagine if they say Hendrix All Along the Watchtower, you know, Frank covered it, and not Dylan's.
Right.
And some of them actually did say it, and it was like, oh my gosh,
yeah,
that's unbelievable.
That's sad.
they were fixated, you know,
yeah.
they had HDS, which is Hendrix Derangement Syndrome.
So what, I mean, here you grew up in Montreal, right?
Yeah.
So what was your inspiration? What was the reason you first picked up the instrument in the first place?
Well, I was a drummer.
Uh-huh.
I played drums as a kid, and I just liked, you know, quote, playing the drums.
Mm-hmm.
And I really liked Buddy Rich, and I really liked Elvin Jones, who happened to play with John Coltrane, so I guess I was hearing Coltrane because I wanted to hear Elvin Jones. and then I blew my mind on LSD and went to a hospital right in the midst of the hippie days, right, 1968, and had to do something to occupy my brain so I wouldn't, you know, freak out forever. And so there was no way I could play drums in the hospital. There happened to be a guitar, you know, like there was a piano, a guitar. Hey, maybe I'd have taken up the piano, but at least I could take the guitar back to my room and sit and noodle with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I became a guitarist. But I really didn't want to be I want to be a guitar player. Like, that wasn't a big thing with me. It was almost like, you know, guitar to me was a kind of therapy, if you want to say, put it this way.
Yeah.
And then it became my best friend. It became my only friend at one point. And because I came out of the hospital, and a lot of the friends of mine, people that had been friends of mine in the hippie days, well, as soon as I came out of the hospital, I wouldn't touch any more drugs.
Right.
I never touched a drug since. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was 13 years old when I did my last drug or drink. I'm 60. I'll be 61 in November.
Right.
But when I came out of the hospital, I was absolutely refusing to touch any drugs just because I was terrified. But you just didn't do that in those days, you know, and have all your friends think you were cool. So right away, I became like this guy that no one wanted to talk to. Oh, he must be a narc or something, you know?
Like, yeah.
And so the guitar became my best friend. It became my only friend for a while.
Right.
That's how I started playing guitar.
And was it, did you find yourself, okay, so you're starting to play the guitar. Did you always listen to a lot of different styles of music? Because when
anybody from my time did, sure.
Yeah, because
you look at the lineup on Woodstock.
Yeah.
Look at how Dustin is sort of the epitome of it.
Yeah.
How similar are any two bands?
Hardly at all.
Hendrix, you've got Shanana, you've got so much variety. It's like a gigantic variety show.
Yeah, oh, it was amazing.
But that's the 60s.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
You didn't begin to hear, first of all, there wasn't FM radio until quite late, you know, like 70-something.
Right.
But you didn't hear, two songs in a row on a radio that had the same sound, whereas today,
right,
or in the 70s especially, you know, they got these things called programmers who go tell the radio guys what they should play.
Yeah.
To get the advertising uniform across the country from left to right.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem. That's what happened to the business. Yeah. My influences were music.
Mm-hmm.
Like anybody from my time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were all the same. And music, you know, it varied so much. Like, I'm so influenced by so many different things. I love Tony Bennett. I've loved Tony Bennett even when I was 16 years old. You know, today people find him really great, but there was a time when no one knew who he was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what has Tony Bennett got to do with Jimi Hendrix? You know, it's so varied.
Right.
So yeah. If I had to list to you everything that influenced my music and my playing, it's really, really, really wide. It's stuff that has nothing to do with my playing. I still think Claude Debussy is, like, you know, one of the greatest composers ever. And so every bit of music that's different, I liked, but I'm not any different. My brothers were the same way, my sister's the same way, everybody. We all like the same stuff.
Right.
We weren't trying to be guitar players in bands, believe me. And they have to bend my arm to sign a contract to make a record. You know, they have to talk me into it.
Right.
Because it was like, oh no, you're joining the dark side. Right?
Well, I could always hear all these different things. And, you know, listening to your music over the years, especially, you know, back then when I was just picking, I picked up the instrument in 75, I picked up the guitar more around 78, but I was a bass player before that, starting around 75, 76. And hearing your music, and every time I would hear something from you, it was always like, well, that's him. And I recognize that it's him, but it's different than the last track I heard. In that, and I didn't.
Oh yeah, that was a big problem, Mark. I mean, I'm talking about the war. You know, the war with the label.
Yeah,
I always was at war with my label. I mean, I was always at war with the label. It was ridiculous because you're right. My albums are a box of chocolates, and they're mixed.
Right.
But if you think about it, the argument that the label had with me. And I'm talking about the actual argument where they would sit me down and say, rah, 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 you need to do this and that, right?
Mm-hmm.
They would say, you can't sell more than one thing to the audience.
Right.
Because you need to be lumped in with one specific sound that people go to get when they know what they want. And you know what? They're right. Because if you think about it, the bands that sell the most are the bands that do sound the same wall to wall on their record.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, if you want a certain type of AC/DC, you get their album, everything's AC/DC front to back. It's not all of a sudden they're doing a soft ballad. You know?
Right.
And if you want Sinatra, you get Sinatra. It's not all of a sudden Sinatra's doing a rock tune.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he could do a rock tune, but mm-hmm. who knows? You know, he doesn't put it on a record.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but what Frank Marino was doing, and I hate to talk about myself in the third person, it's stupid. But anyway, what I was doing was I was saying, well, no, I want to have this variation, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, in a sense, they're right. From a corporate point of view, they're absolutely right. very, you know, way less people will buy something if they can't identify with it on every single track.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, the musicians who were really buying my records,
yeah,
they kind of liked them because of the variation.
Right, but they could also, yes, and you're right, the musicians were able to discern the common thread that was going through right. all of the music, where but they were glomming onto the idea of, wow, Poppy, the track Poppy has all these like jazzy undertones. Oh my God, this is right. amazing. And the tone is fat and it's so, oh my God, this is like getting syrup poured over my ears, you know? And then you got a track like Juggernaut, which was like proto prog rock.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And then metal prog.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah. And then you've got Dragonfly, which is ethereal funk.
Yeah.
But yet it was all the way through when somebody who knew who they were listening to went, ah, yeah, that's him. That's him.
Yeah, because I tell you what the common thread that ran through it was, especially in the early days, was the psychedelia.
Yeah.
You know, the backwards guitars and, you know, guitars being made to overlay and harmonies that did weird things and came out of nowhere, and you know, the speed playing and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
These were the things that people were seeing as the common thread.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, as you said before, the type of sound that it was. Mm-hmm. Because I like sound, which is, hey, you know, for a musician, hey, there's a novel idea. Have a good sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Look, I've been in rooms with musicians in the late 70s, I'm talking about as things began to deteriorate in terms of artistry and people wanting to, you know, putting the cart before the horse. I've been in rooms with musicians of note who told me that I care too much about the sound of the show. If you have to sacrifice something in order to get a bigger light show in there, it doesn't matter if you sacrifice the sound.
Hmm.
Now, that's ridiculous.
That's sad.
Because, you know, and I would use the word selling. Now, I don't like the word selling music. But I would say to them, aren't we selling sound to people? Isn't that what we're selling?
Yeah.
I mean, there's no lights on a record. You know, in those days there were no videos.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we selling if not sound?
Mm-hmm.
So sound was really important to me, and it still is.
Yeah.
Tone, we call it tone, you know. Everyone wants their guitar. You know, there's a lot of really, really great guitar players, fantastic players, who haven't yet found a good tone or a good sound, or maybe they're using the wrong amp or something,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you take that same guy and you put him on the right, you know, give him the right tone, the right production and tone into his guitar, and all of a sudden it's like he's a different guy, but he's playing the same thing.
Yeah. And to that, you know, there's an awful lot. I mean, when you go to iTunes and look you up there, there's an awful lot of live collections of
yeah.
of what you did and what you've done and. And to me, I'm all about the live recording because it's like you can't hide. There's nowhere to hide. I mean, even though a lot of live records are fixed up in the studio and stuff, but you know, live to me is like, okay, that's where an artist really is showing their wares. And your live records to me, you must have spent a lot of time out on the road because.
That's all I did.
Yeah, because it seemed everything seemed so comfortable and so natural on those live recordings, and then even after a while, a lot of the studio records, which were probably recorded mostly live, had that same vibe too. With you, go ahead.
No, yeah. Well, David Krebs used to say that he was my manager in the late part of the 70s. He was a pretty smart guy about those things, and he used to say exactly that: if you can't deliver live,
right,
you have no business doing it,
right.
And you know, because people see through it right away. It's like, whoa, what is this? You know, you can't deliver live.
Right. And he handled you. He handled Aerosmith and Ted Nugent and you know.
Well, he handled a lot of. He had something to do with a lot of acts. A lot of people. You know, Michael Bolton. He had.
Right.
He was even at one point somehow involved with AC/DC's manager.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he handled Beatlemania on Broadway.
Right.
He handled all kinds of different things.
So he got the idea of the live thing. He really got that.
He got it totally. He got it. You know, and he's the one that once told me. He'd say, you know what? It's no longer even a show. He says basically it's cheap psychiatry. people pay their $5 in those days or their $10 to stand on their chairs and scream.
Right.
So, yeah, the live thing, even to this day, I'm still like that. I hear a record or I hear something somebody played, and I'd rather go see it live and see that artist. You know, like, I want to see what's really going on.
Right.
As you say, you can't hide it. But today you can hide it, Mark. You can. Today you've got the Melodyne and, auto-tune, and their live auto-tune on The Voice.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got people using samplers, and today you can hide it.
Yeah.
It's not as analog as it used to be.
Yeah.
You know. So who really knows anymore? I mean, look at Taylor Swift is really like one of the largest artists in the world. And one night I was watching television and her idol Dionne Warwick was up on stage and she wanted to get up and sing live with her in a duet, an impromptu kind of singing thing. And I don't know if you saw that, but it was not very good, and they knew it was not very good, and so they had to put her on TV the next day saying, well, you know, she had a cold and whatever and blah blah blah. Look, if you can't get up and do that live and really play what you're playing, the thing that people are let's say championing you for, why are you there doing it?
I don't
really get it. You watch sports?
Yeah.
I mean, do you ever watch hockey or football or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, isn't the guys that get into the NHL or the NFL or the NBA or Major League Baseball, aren't they supposed to be doing something that the average guy doesn't do in order to be able to get on that team?
Yep.
Because if we went and we saw NHL players and they were doing what we can do in our beer hockey leagues, I don't think we'd want to watch the game.
Right.
We'd rather just go play it.
Right, for sure.
So if a person isn't playing the actual thing live, why are they there? Mm-hmm. What purpose does it serve?
Mm-hmm.
Is it because they're pretty? I don't get it.
Yeah.
And I really don't get it. I'm not telling you that I understand it and I think it's, you know, I've got it all figured out as some nefarious thing. I still don't get it. Guitar players today, look, I mean, what happened, you know, when people stopped thinking about taking the guitar to make some kind of song or sound and started thinking about reading tablature and making sure that you can go as fast as you can and then playing with two hands and then, you know, two hands and extra strings. And it became all about the technique and not about, you know, what was being played. And I'm not saying, you know, that it became that way totally. I'm just saying in a lot of cases.
Well, it did. I mean, there was a point I remember saying, looking at a friend of mine and saying, it was actually a guitarist, Al Petrelli, who played with Alice Cooper. And I remember I said to him, I said, Al, when did guitar become a competition sport?
Yeah. I've often said that you always can recognize the guitar players in the audience because they're the ones standing at the back of the room, not seated, with their arms folded. You know, you're on stage.
In judgment.
A bunch of people sitting and bopping and whatever, and everyone's having a good time, and a lot of the guitar players are at the back of the room standing there in the corners with their arms crossed. 12 o'clock. Start playing, you know. And in some ways, I think that demonstrates a type of, and this is going to sound weird, but the very fact that they do that demonstrates a lack of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost a type of show me something, and by the way, I hope you can't. You know,
because
even Eric Clapton said when he saw Hendrix, he wanted to quit.
Yes.
Now, I can't understand why he should want to quit, because someone else did something else. It has nothing to do with what he's doing. That's like saying, man, you know, a guy who likes women or wants to date and he sees some good-looking guy says, well, I think I'll go home and kill myself.
Right.
You know, it shows you that there's a competitive nature there.
Yes.
That, unfortunately, guitar players, of all the musicians in the bands, have that the most. Drummers don't do that.
Yeah.
Drummers are the happiest guys in the world when they meet other drummers or see other drummers who are fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
They think it's great.
Yeah, you're right. That is very true.
I hang around drum boards. Like, you know, when we go on the web, message boards. I go to a lot of message boards, you know, drummer boards.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's no flaming going on, and there's no mm-hmm. smart remarks going on, and mm-hmm. there's no pontificating. Everyone's helping everybody.
Yeah.
It's like the drummers remind me of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just into their drums. That's it. They'll wear little drumsticks around their neck, and they'll talk drums, and they'll play drums, and they love every other drummer, no matter how bad or good the guy is. They love him.
Yeah.
With guitarists are like the most competitive, but the least likely to actually show it.
Right.
Because they know it's not a good thing.
Yeah, you know.
So they have it.
Yeah.
But they don't show it.
Yeah, and that was something that I guess that's why I've always been on the fringe, kind of on the outside looking in, because I was always never happy with my playing, so I was always in awe of everybody. You know,
I'm still in awe of everybody. You know, if anybody, you know, you hear guys like Tommy Emmanuel. I mean,
oh yeah,
it's unbelievable how, and I'm in awe of what he's doing.
Yeah.
Because it sounds so good.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds so good. When he makes an acoustic guitar, it's only a harp.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in awe of that.
Yeah.
But I'm in awe of other guys who don't play fast at all, you know? And so it's not really about speed with me. It's just about, I love it when people are contributing something to music in general. We're like, music is the big boss. And we're all the soldiers of music.
Yeah.
We're all following music. It's an impersonal boss. It doesn't judge us.
Yeah.
We judge it seems.
But you know what, though, Frank, though? When you played fast, musically. That was the thing. That was the difference for me. You know, it was sort of like, I remember early on, too, as a kid, watching Hee Haw and seeing Roy Clark play. Roy Clark played fast, but he played fast musically. I was always,
right.
I was more inspired. And the same thing when I first heard Eddie Van Halen, his guitar solos were little songs within the song, you know?
Yeah, those phrases, yeah.
Yeah, phrases, that's really what it needs to be. But if it's just this, you know, this masturbation of some kind that is just flurries of notes that make no sense, and like, well, we had to put something somewhere, we put it here. Yeah, that just doesn't do it for me. I just don't get that.
Well, look, the way you could look at it is this. I've often said that music is a language, right? It is a language.
Absolutely.
And it's a communicative thing. And like any language, it has an alphabet.
Right.
Of its own.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to learn to speak it like any language and to understand it like any language. And once you learn the alphabet, then you learn how to structure those notes or alphabet letters into words that mean something. Whereas you could structure them into words that mean nothing. Just like we could take our own alphabet and do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you've structured structured them into words that mean something as groupings. Then putting the words together to say sentences is another thing. And all of this is done on the typewriter, let's say, which is the guitar or any instrument you're playing, whether it's sax. And so how are you going to structure that? You know, if you were in school and you liked English writing, the teacher would say, do an essay on, you know, some subject. You have to use the same typewriter and the same letters and the same language as everybody else. But some guys would write some pretty good stuff. So, you know, just and it's all in the question of which words they use. The funny thing about it is, if you read a really good book, and I'm going back to the language thing here, if you read a really good book that just totally captivates you, and then you read a book that bores you to hell, you'll notice that on the pages of each of that book, all the same words are there. You can find, you know, the words of in the good book, you can find them in the boring book, too. All the same words are there.
Yeah.
But how are they put together?
Yeah.
So it's a rearrangement of words on a page all of a sudden becomes interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
With the same words.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a conversation. You don't say the same words over and over again either.
Right. You know, and it should be spontaneous, you know?
Yeah.
Could you imagine if you're interviewing me and I'm talking from a script and you're talking from a script, it would be ridiculous.
Yeah.
It'd sound like some kind of robots or something.
Absolutely.
You know? So I tell the guitar players today, you know, listen a lot. Listen. And play, you know, put phrases together that say something. You know, try to mean what you say. One trick, it's actually a trick that I teach whenever I teach my technique to people, and I hate to use the word technique, but is, you know, at the beginning when you're first doing this, only play something when you're breathing out. And never play when you're breathing in. 'Cause that's what you do when you speak. So it's a way, think about it. Horn players can't play notes while they're breathing in.
Yeah. I get it. I actually heard Pat Metheny say that once, too, that he said that's the one thing about the guitar, it's missing a breath element, so he tries to mimic that. Yeah, that makes sense.
Imitate the strength of it, and when you push your breath more or push it less or play it softly, it's all about the breathing.
Yeah, right? Totally.
And so, yeah, it works. It's a great technique for guitar players to use to sort of get used to the timing of how you're phrasing. Because even I go off sometimes with a, you know, a nutty run that lasts forever and never stops going quick. Look, you know, I do that. I'm not going to say I don't. And it's sometimes a little too fast. And, you know, I know because I'm the producer of my own record, sometimes I can't hear what the heck I'm doing. You know, I'm like, oh my God, you know, what's the guitar doing here? I can't tell what notes it's playing. It's too quick. You know?
Yeah.
And it's quick with slurs. It's not, you know, I'm doing, I don't play a lot of the 16 things to the bar, you know, like really on time things. If you parse out what I'm playing on a guitar during a solo, it's very rarely that they're broken up into fours and 16s, the groupings.
Yeah.
Because words aren't. Otherwise, we'd sound like we were talking in limerick.
Right. So, over the...
Now, people that are listening to this, is it guitar players?
Mostly? Oh, yeah, mostly, yeah. Guitar players and bass players. That's our audience.
Well, I'm sure today they're understanding what I'm saying, but let me ask you a question.
Sure.
What's up with the tablature thing? What is this interest in a numerical, you know, a further bastardization of music couldn't have been made, the tablature?
Yeah, I think that's something that came out of the I mean, that's all Nashville, right? And that's all, I think that came out of there. I think it came out of the, remember the fake book? I think it came out of that whole thing too. You know, it's a bastardized version of those two worlds that kind of, I don't know, but I see it in the back of every magazine and I'm like, okay, well, let me flip to the next thing. For me, it's always been about, I mean, I grew up learning guitar off of the radio. I had a great ear. I was able to pick stuff off, and I developed it that way. And then later went to music school and became a classical guitar player. And then, of course, everything related to back to the blues. But it's always been about the ear. It's always been because I feel like there's more of a visceral connection between what's being fed into my brain and my heart.
Well, yeah, I say it all the time. Use your ears. Listen. I have three daughters that play music. Not one of them was taught except to use their ears, and they're all great musicians.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I'm astringent on that. It's like, you know, Dad, how do I play Poppy? Dad, how do I play Stories of a Hero? You know, well, go listen to it, and you'll figure it out.
Right.
And they did.
Right.
You know, now I'm not against the reading of music in terms of for the type of music.
Mm-hmm.
We have to understand why music was written, you know, in the days that it was written from a classical point of view.
Right.
And we have to also remember that a lot of the great composers who composed their things there, they had to do that without hearing their band.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's no band that they could say, oh, play this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, change it. Let's overdub it. Mm-hmm. You know, they couldn't do that. They had to see it on the page.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed a way of visibly viewing when the notes go up and when the notes go down.
Yeah.
At least in classical music, you can literally visually see that things are going to go up and things are going to go down. You see what's going on.
Right.
But at the same time, if you're not listening to it, it's like cooking from a recipe without tasting the food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they might tell you put a tablespoon of salt, but it might be a tablespoon and a half. And you don't know that until
right.
you taste it.
Right.
And so in music, we're tasting as we go. You know, we're playing and we're tasting as we go.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a one-size-fits-all. So now back to the tablature thing. Tablature does not... You know, for the life of me, you can't see the music on tablature.
Right.
You can learn how to put your fingers in the right places, and
mm-hmm.
then you'll hear it afterward.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't see the music.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't imagine the music from tablature.
I think it's also an instant gratification thing, too.
Well, yeah, it's a quick way of saying, wow, if I read this, I'll be able to play what my hero played.
Right.
And here I go. Now I'm him.
Right.
But isn't that a bit like the ski bunny thing, you know, who doesn't really ski but buys the best skis and the best everything because they think the best gear is going to make them a better skier?
Well, there's a lot of people
like that. The best skates are going to make them a better hockey player?
Oh, yeah. Once again, there's corporate hype, okay?
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
You get back to that whole thing of, you know, hey, if you got this, you got this, you got this, you're hip.
And you know, they get them addicted on it.
Yeah.
They're addicted to it. And because, you know, the corporations know very well that a man with an addiction has very little sales resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they do.
Yeah. Well, you know,
get addicted on
it. It's funny because one of the guys, I was recently speaking with Eric Gales. And he cites you as you're one of his main influences coming up. And he told me, he said, you know what? Honestly, all I need, you can give me a Squire Strat and a pig nose amp, and I'm going to make music.
Yeah, he's right. And he is.
Yeah.
To make music.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, listen, yeah, that's so true. Well, look, I build gear. Mm-hmm. I learned to build gear because I couldn't buy it.
Right.
It was one of those necessities, the mother of invention, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I can't get a tone. I'm going to have to learn to build it myself.
Right.
So I build amps and I build pedals, and it took me a long time to learn how to do it, and I tinkered a lot. But that's what I do because that's, to me, part of crafting the sound of it.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of guys that say, you know, gee, I don't know what's happening. I bought these pedals and I put them here and my sound is no good and I don't know what to do and I want to kill myself. You know, like they'll run into a guy who's technically proficient. They'll look at an amp builder as if he's a god.
Yeah.
You know, they want him as their best friend.
Yeah.
And because they really want the gear to do it for Mm-hmm. I mean, it all goes, it's all together, you know, it all goes together.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember when I first learned a long, long time ago, when I was very young, and I, you know, spent a lot of time trying to get a different sound. So I would go and get, you know, plug this pedal into that pedal, or go tweak an equalizer this way or that way, and just, you know, going on for hours, mm-hmm. trying to get a second guitar to fit into a track. Then I realized that the easiest way is just change guitars. Mm-hmm. That works way better than, you know, if you do one track with an SG and you do another one with a Strat or a Les Paul, they're going to sound characteristically so different that you don't have to tweak dials and push buttons. It does it for you.
Right.
Just change guitars.
Yeah.
Use a different voicing, really. I figured that out really, really early on.
Well, and then also, don't you think that those three instruments in particular, they make you approach it in a different way too?
Oh yeah, totally. Completely. A person plays his instrument according to the feel and the sound that he's got at the time. And if you stick a Gretsch Country Gentleman to a guy's hand, he's gonna play a certain way than if you give him an Ibanez flat necked, you know, mm-hmm. shredder guitar. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's gonna play different.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I have never owned a semi hollow guitar. In fact, I hadn't played a whole lot of semi-hollow guitars in my life. It was all about solid bodies, Tellys, Strats, and Les Pauls and the such. And then I happened to acquire one and playing it, and I was like, oh, wow, this is different.
Yeah, and it's cool.
Yeah.
It's a really cool experience, you know?
Yeah.
Like, classical guitar, you know, when I was at home, like, I learned all the stuff that I'm telling you, I learned on a classical guitar, but mm-hmm. it had steel strings on it.
Uh-huh.
You know, it wasn't nylon. And all that, you know, sitting in the hospital learning that playing guitar that was done on this old classical, steel string classical guitar that they happened to have in the hospital.
Right.
And it makes you different. Just makes you different at the nature of the instrument. Now, I have some acoustic guitars. Like, if I play my Taylor guitar, it makes me play different than if I play my Guild guitar.
Uh-huh.
Just because of the sound.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
And the feel of the neck, right?
Yep.
And actually write different tunes mm-hmm. on different instruments.
Oh, totally.
It makes you write a different kind of tune.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't agree more. Absolutely.
When the synthesizer came along, you know, we used to have this expression, every new module had one good song in it. Because some guy, you know, some Japanese programmer in a lab coat happened to put one sound in there that was really cool, and you'd end up writing a song around the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the greatest example of that is when people started using that, what they call the orchestra hit. You know, it's like that bump, bump, and a big orchestra hit. They started putting them into tunes, and you started hearing it everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, some Roland thing.
Yeah.
You know?
The stab.
When you think about it, the guy that made that sound wasn't even a musician. I mean, he's not getting any royalties from all those hits, you know?
It's the Velcro of music.
Yeah. It's really... But you know what? Everything has its use, right?
So, yeah.
I'm not a purist at all. By any stretch of the imagination, I will use transistors, I'll use tubes, I'll use old, I'll use new. Nothing is impure for me,
right.
You know? And there's a way to fit something into the music you're making.
Right.
But I think you need to listen to that instrument first and then find out how it fits rather than trying to think it up in advance, trying to bend the instrument to your will.
Right. And it's a tool to get your the desired intention.
Yeah, because that's at the end of the day, isn't that really, you know, what it is?
That's what it's all about.
To get it out there as an intention, yeah.
Yep.
It's like writing that book, writing that novel.
Absolutely. But
I'm not a purist.
You've been fairly dedicated though to the Gibson SG Les Paul thing.
You know why?
No, why?
It's only because that's the first guitar my mother bought me when I got out of the hospital.
Ah.
So I didn't know that it was a Gibson when I got that. It wasn't like, wow, I got a Gibson. You know, who knew what a Gibson was? Like, so what? You know, Gibson meant it meant nothing, you know?
Right.
And by the way, when Jimi Hendrix came out playing a Stratocaster in those days, everyone thought that was the weirdest thing in the world.
Because
nobody played Stratocasters.
Because of what? The single coil?
No, it had nothing to do with the single coil. It just looked weird.
Oh, okay.
So, because nobody was playing Stratocasters, I mean, who was really playing Stratocasters then? Even Eric Clapton was playing an SG.
Yeah, the surf guys.
Zappa was playing an SG.
Yeah.
Other guys were playing Les Pauls and Gibson guitars. All of a sudden, this guy comes along playing a Stratocaster, which you'd really only see guys playing in soul bands. Stratocasters or Telecasters.
Yeah. And surf bands and country bands.
The tone of that guitar placed into a heavy amplifier became his sound.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until many years later that guys made an industry out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Stratton the Marshall. Everybody, you know, Robin Trower didn't play a Stratton the Marshall when he played for Procol Harum.
What did he play?
But later on he did.
Huh.
You know, so. Well, I don't know what he played, but his tone wasn't the same.
No,
for sure.
Yeah, I mean, when I hear the Procol Harum tunes, it's like night and day.
Yeah, you hear Shine On Brightly or whatever, and you hear the guitar.
Yeah.
It's not. It can't be the same equipment,
right,
you know?
Right.
But then you hear Bridge of Sighs, you go, yep, there it is.
Yeah.
You know, like everyone went to this Stratton the Marshall. But the weird thing about that was, that always bugged me, you know, because I was getting the Hendrix hype thing that was like, put down for the Hendrix thing, was everyone went to this Stratton this Marshall and played that kind of music. And I say everyone loosely, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they'd say, Jimmy who? You know, like, it was like they wouldn't even acknowledge that that's what was influencing them.
Yeah.
It just became the thing.
Yeah.
And here I was, 16-year-old kid, do an album, and I write on it dedicated to Jimi Hendrix. What a mistake that was, in terms of what would end up happening to me from it.
Yeah, yeah.
But people don't know that I walked out on Jimi Hendrix's concert in 1968 because I thought it was crap. How many people did that and then ended up hearing his name for the rest of their life? It's like a kind of curse.
It's amazing.
It's almost like, yeah, I'll make sure you never forget my name, man.
You should have never walked out on that gig.
Yeah. Listen, I saw the Soft Machine that night, and, you know, Robert Wyatt did a really great drum solo, and they had a Liquid Light show and stuff. And then after, Jimi Hendrix comes out, and it was like just a bunch of noise that I thought, oh my God, this is like, I can't hear anything.
You know, it's so funny you should say that, because early on, when I first started hearing Hendrix and people were turning me on to it, I was saying, my palate was not ready for that.
Yeah.
I was like, this is incredibly overly distorted. I didn't get it. And to be perfectly honest with you, I didn't start really getting Hendrix. And I've said this before on this show. I didn't really start getting it and really appreciating it until I was probably in my late 20s, maybe even early 30s. Now I get it. I understand what he did and how he helped to change things. But when I was in my youth, I was more about preciseness and clean tones. When I say clean tones, clean distorted tones, if you know what I mean. You know.
So did you become one of the beginners in that neoclassical? Is that where you went?
No, not at all. It was always blues based for me. It was always, Well, you, Leslie West.
And how did all of that dovetail or jive with you having gone to classical guitar school? How did you?
Well, see, all through junior high and high school, I was listening to all that music, and I was listening to, like, and I loved Cheap Trick. I loved that band. I love the idea of taking the sensibilities of some of those Beatlesque harmonies and chord structures and making them really heavy, you know. And yeah. I love that, especially their first album. And I was listening to all that and a lot of radio, because at that time radio was still pretty good, especially college radio. And then, you know, I all the while taking music theory in high school, had some great teachers. And the only place to go for me after high school where I wanted to study music, I had to go into a classical program because there was nothing else offered to me. So I said, okay, well, that's what I'll do. And then I learned Bach pieces and Villa-Lobos and stuff like that. And I was like, you know, this is fine and dandy, but it's not for me. I'm a blues guy, and I want to play more blues. You know, and through that time, I started discovering like Freddie King, you know, B.B. Right. King and all that. And I was like, this is more like it for me. But I did end up in a hair band.
Hair band, yeah.
You know, I ended up in a hair band in the 80s, you know, but we were always a blues-based hair band. We wanted to sound like you and Aerosmith but of, you know, the era that of yore, you know what I mean? We wanted to sound like that. You know, it's so funny because, like, when we ended up hearing Guns N' Roses, the first time I heard Guns N' Roses, I was like, oh, they're Aerosmith. They're trying to be Aerosmith.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, and they'd say the same. I mean, I would like to think that they would say the same thing. They wanted to be Aerosmith. I mean, and who did Aerosmith want to be? Aerosmith wanted to be the Stones.
Right. You know, because we had the same manager, you know, Aerosmith and I, for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
They too, in the beginning, had this, you know, this thing against the quote unquote Hendrix ripoff guy. You know, it's like, yeah, when I got to open for them, and it was always that story. You know, and one day David told me that one day one of them said, you know, well, you know, this guy, he shouldn't be on our shows because it's a Hendrix ripoff, blah blah blah. And David got mad about that, and he said back to the guy, he goes, oh. He said, this from the American Rolling Stones? That's actually how he answered.
Yeah, I've heard Steve Tyler say dozens of times that he'd be on a plane and people would say, oh, look, it's Mick Jagger.
Yeah. But you know what? It is what it is, and people do what they do. And like I say, that competitiveness you mentioned earlier on,
mm-hmm.
that completely was the downfall of music. That was the downfall of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't work together. They worked at cross purposes.
Yeah.
Everyone was trying to outgun the other one. They created words like guitar slinger.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, axe man and mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They engendered this competitive edge,
yeah,
where the camaraderie was feigned and fake. And what was really going on was the guitar version of a bunch of girls at the dance having, you know, catty feelings towards the other. You know, where, oh, I love your hair.
Yeah.
Where a doll, you know, really not loving her hair.
Yeah. Yeah, and that kind of happened again.
It ruined music. I mean, look, nobody was... We look at a Hendrix album where he's got Stevie Winwood playing with him and he's got this guy playing with him.
Yeah.
You know, people got together in those days, not just on stage and not just in the studios, and they hung out at people's houses and they made music together.
Yeah.
And that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
And I've often said, when I started, you know, in the band, making a band and all that, nobody from my era, at least not in my generation, maybe before me, maybe after for sure, but nobody really said, oh, you know, let's be in a band and then let's be famous and, you know, and let's make records and let's, you know. No, people took their instruments over to their friends' houses to play,
mm-hmm.
the same way kids take their video games over to their friends' houses to play.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing it for the fun, and they're not saying, gee, I'm going to do this so I can be a video game designer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody was doing that with their guitars.
right,
so that they could be guitar players in bands.
Right.
It was just a way of having fun.
Right, and then what's going to happen is, you're right, because I'm seeing that with my son. You know, and what we're going to see is we are going to see some people come out of that and be these amazing video game designers.
Yeah.
You know, it'll be a handful. It won't be a lot of them. It won't be all of them. It'll be some of them.
Right.
Yeah.
But the real root of why they played the video games, and by the way, I'm a gamer.
Uh-huh.
And the real root of why they play them was the fun.
Yeah.
And the vicarious living through the video game of being the character in the game.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, once that started to happen in music, once the fun started going out of it, yeah, sure, you could interview a lot of the guys and they'll tell you it's fun and they're having a great time. But it's not true. Because they all have the right catchwords. It's like when we see athletes, you know, interview hockey players or whatever. They always say the same things, the cliches, and, you know, well, they're back to the wall and take it one day at a time, and, you know, there's a lot of pride in that room over there, and, you know, they all say the same things because it's the polite thing to say, but I guarantee you that's not what they're thinking.
Right. It's the standard responses.
Yeah, and that has started to happen in music, and the standard response was to sort of, you know, pretend that there's a lot of camaraderie when in fact there's a lot of competitiveness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there shouldn't be any.
Yeah.
Not just little.
Yeah.
There shouldn't be any.
So do you think now with the DIY generation we'll start to see that kind of camaraderie again?
Well, I hope so. Yeah, you know what? I think what will contribute to it more than anything is the slow realization that no matter how good you get today, no matter how good you are, or technically or even creatively, you're never going to be one of those major acts like they used to have.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to happen anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At best, you're going to play some theaters.
Right.
And the you know, you're not going to be the Cal. It's not going to happen anymore. There's
right.
not going to be a major star like that or a major influence in terms of, you know, 80,000 people coming to see some guy work his magic. That's over. And it's been over for a long, long, long time.
Yeah.
Basically, that whole rock thing about, you know, toiling around there to become to make it. They
mm-hmm.
say the word make it.
Mm-hmm.
I often say that to people who are in bed still thinking that way, you know, I say, well, did you ever see The Sixth Sense? You're like Bruce Willis, and The Sixth Sense is walking around dead and you don't know it.
Yeah.
Because it's over. That music industry megastar on a guitar I'm
mm-hmm.
talking about,
mm-hmm.
that'll never happen again.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. You got guys like Tobin Abasi who play so good on 8 strings or 7 strings. Just guys that are doing ridiculously amazing good things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not doing anything to make them that big monster.
Mm-hmm.
It's not doing anything. It's
yeah.
over. The kids are not interested in that.
Yeah. Do you think?
So in a sense, I hope that helps build a kind of musical camaraderie, because as long as people don't go into it in the first place thinking they've got to outshine the other guy,
right,
then they'll all work together to make good music.
Yeah.
They don't care about outshining the other guy.
That's true. But the whole idea of the you know, the really popular guitar player again, I wonder if that's full circle, if at some point in time that might happen again.
Well, popularity, sure. Among other players, popularity is going to happen.
Yeah, I mean,
I was talking.
I was talking to Paul.
What about the public at large? They're not all players.
Well, that's the thing, and they weren't then either, though.
But that's what I'm saying. When a bunch of people got together to go see Janis Joplin, or they weren't all singers,
right?
And, you know, a bunch of people got together to say they wanted. Even today, guys like Stevie Wonder, and they draw these huge crowds of people. They're not all singers and writers. They're just average people. Some of them are singers and writers.
Right.
And but the guitar thing became this kind of thing. It was almost like, oh, this, you see this guitar player, and, you know, 50,000 people would get together to see Angus do his thing with a school bag on his back. You know? But they weren't all liking him because he was a guitarist. They were liking AC/DC.
Right.
And some of them were guitarists.
Mm-hmm.
But there are too many players who think that they're going to go woodshed their craft and get better and better and better at it, better than the next guy at it, and that alone is what's going to make them this megastar. In the end, that's not going to happen. There are no more Jimi Hendrixes.
Right.
Not because there can't be, but because times have changed.
Yeah.
And beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and the beholder today knows so much about the guitar. They've been so overfed with it.
There's no longer
any mystery.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so funny too that you should say this, because I have a blog. The guy who writes blogs for our website, who's a really great guitar player and knows so much about guitar, Adam Hunt. He and I often speculate: will we see another Hendrix? Will we see another Stevie Ray Vaughan? Are we going to see who's going to be that next person to take the mantle up? And we just don't even have a clue of what that would look like, sound like, you know, what kind of shoes they're wearing. We don't have an idea.
Well, look, if it ever happens, mm-hmm. Firstly, I don't think it'll happen because of guitar. There may be a guy that does that, but guitar will have little to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
He'll happen to play guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe what he's writing will do it. Maybe what he's singing will do it. But it won't be because of what he's playing, because... Listen, it's really, there's nothing that somebody isn't doing anymore.
Right, there's nothing left. We've blazed our trail.
Can do anything in terms of fusion, you know. Like if I needed a guy to play that kind of stuff, I'd call Alan Holdsworth.
Yeah.
He can do it all.
Right.
You know, why would I call the other 10 guys? Alan can do it.
Right.
You know, and there's somebody somewhere that's mastered the craft. There are 10-year-olds on YouTube that are doing this stuff.
Right.
10-year-olds.
Right.
And 9-year-olds.
Right. And they don't know who Alan Holdsworth is.
Exactly. So where's the magic anymore in the instrument? There's no more magic. We didn't love Jimi Hendrix wasn't a technically proficient guitar player.
No, he played. He played.
He played from pretty slow.
It was sexual energy.
Yeah, exactly. So what we loved about it wasn't. I keep saying this. It wasn't his guitar playing we loved.
Right.
And by the way, when we listened to one of those records in those days, no one ever singled out the instrument.
Not
no
then.
One ever said, "Wow, listen to the guitar."
Not then. Not then. They do now.
Yeah, but I'm saying back then, it was like, what they're doing now is they're taking a sip of soup and they're saying, wow, taste the salt. You know what I'm saying? They're singling out the components.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not music. That's like listening to a guitar and singling out the E string.
Well, and that's what's happened, and the internet has really been the petri dish for all of this,
yeah.
of this dissection of, and I'm just as guilty, because I'm a gear nut, and I mean, when I was a kid, I would go ahead and I would do this with you, and I did it with Eddie Van Halen, and I don't play anything like you guys, and I'd do it with everybody. I would go ahead and take the solos out of a song and put them in a montage.
Right.
On a cassette tape, and I would listen to the phrasing, you know, and then I would listen to the song on its own and understand the structure of the song, but I would pull the solo apart because I was such a bad soloist, and
I was such a bad soloist. Why do you think that was?
Because I was always about the song. It was always the song. Learning songs was always very important to me. Melody was always very important to me. And I for some reason, I gravitated and gleaned that much easier than the actual technique of a solo. I think that's really what it was.
And what do you understand about that now?
What I understand about that now is, and it's funny, and I didn't know this until... And people are going to think this is crazy. I didn't understand this until I became a Taoist. When I became a Taoist and started studying Chinese medicine, I learned about something called Li, which is intention or intent. And I realized very early on that my intention was everything. And the more that I was able to make the solo, the song within the song,
right,
that's when it became evident to me. That's how, where everything started to change.
But I was about to ask you that question when you said before, you know, you were into melody, but you couldn't solo.
Right.
I was really going to ask you, was it solo just in a song, a melody within the song? I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
That is what it is.
It is.
And hasn't it always been that?
And it has. Like, and I didn't get that.
So self-evident.
I didn't get that. I didn't get it. I just, for some reason, my hands couldn't do it. It really wasn't my hands. It was my head.
But if you think back to prior to my time and prior to your time, mm-hmm. or even somewhat when my time began, if you think back to any popular song that was what you know, what a lot of people gravitated towards, whether it was a Beatle tune or whatever.
Right.
When the solo break came along.
Yeah.
The soloist usually imitated what the vocal line was.
Usually.
In a kind of a different way.
Yeah.
You know, in Sunshine of Your Love, he sort of plays this kind of, you know, people have said that that solo is the lyrics of Blue Moon, you know? Blue mm-hmm. Moon, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right?
Right.
That's what Clapton used.
Mm-hmm.
The solo in the song usually is the same thing the singer was singing for a bridge or two in a slightly different way. It mm-hmm. is the song again.
Yeah.
The song.
Yeah. Well, I saw
that's him. That's how I approach solos.
Totally. I mean, about 4 or 5 years ago, I saw Clapton and Beck did a tour, and they were doing Moon River.
Right.
And, you know, Clapton sang the melody, and then when they went for the solo, Beck played the melody, basically the vocal right. line, back on a slide, and it was
right.
and it was perfect.
Right, which is the way it should be.
Yeah,
I totally agree with that.
Yeah,
that's why I was telling you that even as I was young, I loved Tony Bennett.
Yeah, yeah,
because you know the guy sings a tune. Mm-hmm. Without any what we call coloratura,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just the notes placed in the right place,
mm-hmm.
sang really well,
mm-hmm.
great chords behind it.
Yeah.
It's this. I love that kind of stuff. I'm not a guy who, and I'm sure you're not either now, you know, who thinks that there needs to be some kind of technique in something. And if anything, the technique should be to become... have the instrument become invisible to the song.
Yeah.
I mean, we build a house with all kinds of tools, and we build a real nice house with it, but nobody's championing the tools.
Mm-hmm.
Or how well the guy used the tool.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we may admire the work of a great architect, but it's the overall house that we admire. We don't start looking at the fact of how he came up and which, you know, what saw he used to build it and how greatly he cut a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to do that with music. We should stop compartmentalizing it into the instruments and the technique of the instrument.
Right.
You know, that whole thing about getting good on the technique of the instrument, leave that to the schooling days so that it becomes second nature to you, and then you don't think about the instrument. If I give you a guitar right now, you're going to put it in your hand, and you're probably going to put your hand in an E position, you know, E major, and strum it.
Right.
And that's because that's become, you know, second nature to you. And if I ask you now, as a guy who can play, a proficient guitar player, play like you can't. Like, play as if you can't play. It's going to be hard for you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be really, really hard for you to fake sounding like you can't play.
Right.
It won't sound quite accurate like you can't play. But if you turn it around to your left hand and play it, it'll sound accurate like you can't play.
Totally. That's just...
So it's become second nature. And, you know, the same guy playing it right-handed is playing it left-handed.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, one way he can play and one way he can't.
Right.
Same brain.
Yeah, that's so true, too. It's so funny because I'm a left-handed guitar player.
Okay, well, in your case, I would say flip that.
And I will. Sometimes I'll flip over a right-handed guitar, and I'll just say, and it makes me think in a completely different way. And yeah. I remember studying with I studied with two old jazz cats years ago, Sid Margolis and Stanley Solo. And when they every once in a while, when I'd come in, they go, "Ooh, let me see your guitar." And they would turn it over, and they would hold it in the right-handed position, but the strings were upside down. And they were like, right. "This makes me think differently."
Yeah, it does.
You know? So,
My bass player, Peter Dose, of many years, he played his bass that way. He's left-handed, but he used a right-handed bass.
Yeah.
And then for many years, he did that, 20 years, and then he flipped the strings around and learned the other way, too.
Wow, that's pretty good.
The two different approaches, you know, gave him two different, entirely different feels.
Yeah.
But like I'm saying, that's still holding it the same way. If you flip now your guitar into the other hand,
oh, yeah.
Strings or no strings,
oh, yeah.
Then you'll be able to sound like you can't play.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And so, yeah, here's the weird thing. It's the same human with the same brain,
mm-hmm.
with the same knowledge, with the same history,
mm-hmm.
can sound like a total amateur on one side, and put it the other side, it's so second nature to him,
mm-hmm.
that he can't possibly sound like he can't play.
Right.
So what is the difference? The difference is one side has become second nature. And how did he get that second nature? Practice.
All right, we're going to put a pin in it right there. But you can tune in next week for part two of our definitive interview with Mr. Frank Marino. Wow, this has been amazing. Listening back to this during the whole editing process, this has been a trip to hear this. So, so damn cool. All right, folks, don't forget guitarradioshow.com. Don't forget Adam's blog on Thursday, which is tomorrow, and on Steve Marriott. I think you're going to enjoy that. And we got to get out of here. But in the meantime, take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Keep on playing. And we'll see you on the next episode of Guitar Radio Show. Peace.
I like this crowd already.
GRS Productions.